Hi, I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli, and I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Village Voice.
I'm Terry Teachout of The Wall Street Journal.
And I'm Peter Marks of The Washington Post. Welcome to the eighth episode of Three on the Isle, a twice-monthly podcast from New York about theater in America. We are hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group. So, guys, the great work begins again. On this episode, we're going to talk about the return of a two-part play widely viewed as one of the greatest American dramas of the late 20th century, Tony Kushner's celebrated Angels in America. It's back on Broadway for the first time since the early 1990s in a production from London that stars Andrew Garfield and Nathan Lane. We'll soon be able to fully gauge how eager or not audiences in a new century are to revisit this politically charged story set during the AIDS crisis of the Reagan era.
And later on in the podcast, we will be chatting with the Chicago Tribune's longtime chief theater critic, Chris Jones, and we'll discuss the health and prospects of a contemporary classic that is now traveling the country and is currently breaking the box office in London, a little show you may have heard of called Hamilton.
Chris is going to stay around with us for our closing segment when each of us talks about some notable work we've seen of late. Peter is just back from London, where he sampled some of the most talked-about productions there, while Chris will give us the benefit of his own deep knowledge of Chicago theater.
But first, we're going to talk about Tony Kushner and the second flight of his Angels, which I think you'll agree has to account as one of the centerpiece events of the Broadway season. Marianne Elliott of War Horse fame, of all people, directed this revival for the National Theater a year ago. And in his review of the quote-unquote beautifully staged production that now transfers with cast almost completely intact to Broadway, The Guardian's highly regarded Michael Billington wrote that, quote, Kushner's apocalyptic view of American politics now looks amply justified. The action takes place at the start of Reagan's second term, he wrote, and in one scene, a Justice Department official exults in the possibilities ahead. It's really the end of liberalism, he says, the end of New Deal socialism, the end of ipso facto secular humanism, the dawning of a genuinely American political personality. Even allowing for the intervening presidencies of Clinton and Obama, Billington wrote, this has a chilling resonance today. And it comes as no surprise to learn that the corrupt Roy Cohn, one of the play's major characters, acted as Donald Trump's legal advisor for a decade. Well, that is a wonderfully resonant part of this play, given what we're going through in this country today. But Terry and Elizabeth, my question is, do you think Angels really did foretell the end of progressive thought in America? That seems a sweeping generalization by a British observer. But Terry, I know you've been reading the new book out about Angels in America, an important new book, I think you think. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that as we sort of explore Angels.
Yes. Well, as for Mr. Billington, I do think from this perspective, progressive thought seems to be very much alive and well at the present moment, just not in the White House. And as for Angels,
there's no thought whatsoever in the White House, right, liberal or otherwise.
Yeah. Right.
As for Angels, it is continuing to be produced not just on Broadway, but around the world. But it is, as Peter says, the subject of a new book, a really first-rate oral history of the show compiled by Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce, whose title comes from one of the play's best-remembered lines, "The world only spins forward." Now, it happens that I was interviewed for this book, and I would like to start by reading you one of the things I had to say, since it's highly relevant both to our discussion and to this revival.
Please do.
And I said, I don't think it's exaggerating to say that Angels is a history play. If it continues to live on the stage, then it will undoubtedly be produced in ways that are intended to underline its continuing contemporary relevance. It will be treated with the same flexibility that we treat Shakespeare's history plays. And that's what I'm thinking as I prepare to see Angels once again. Not only is the play itself a quarter century old, but it describes events that took place in the 80s when I was 30 and when a great many of the people who will be coming to see it on Broadway had yet to be born. For them, the AIDS crisis is history. And Roy Cohn, the central character, is a vaguely remembered historical figure, if that much. Now, for me, Cohn was somebody who was very much around when I moved to New York in 1985, and whom I remember very clearly. The men who played him in the last two New York productions of Angels, Ron Liebman, F. Murray Abraham, and Frank Wood, knew who he was and what he was like, and they deliberately tried to evoke that memory. I'm mentioning all this because Nathan Lane, who's playing Roy Cohn in this revival, is nothing like Cohn, not physically and not as a stage persona, and I'm very curious to see how he takes on the part. Might his performance foreshadow the way in which a new generation of viewers are going to experience and understand Angels in America? I really look forward to finding out.
Well, you know, that is an interesting question because, you know, one of the things is, you know, Cohn is an important character in Angels, but he's really not the central character. It's interesting that we are putting so much emphasis on Cohn. And, you know, I don't think Kushner intended us to see this play at all through Cohn's eyes. In fact, I mean, he's almost an ironic addition to the cast.
Well, I think this is just...
Yeah, I actually think it'd be a better play if he had.
Well, I think this is just the focus on Cohn right now is clearly just because of the casting of Nathan Lane. That's
and
bringing
also the
a
Trump
lot of,
connection,
right.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a coincidence that the subtitle of the play is a gay fantasia on national themes. This is not a docudrama where you have to have a very similitude of between right. actor and, you know, and subject. It's a fantasia. And what works about it still, I think, although I haven't seen the new show, obviously, yet, but...
When you're seeing it, it's very soon?
I'm going next week.
Right.
Is that next week or the full... Close enough.
Soon.
is that it is... It's to me, it's the fantasia that's the most important. And any production that is not going to tackle this aspect is going to miss the point. And
yeah, I was when I was in Houston a couple of weeks ago, I had an assistant director on the show I was working on who's a young gay man who told me that what he wants to do as a director is direct plays that deal with the experience of millennial gays, for which a play like Angels, a play like The Boys in the Band, which is also coming to Broadway, is a lot less relevant. And I was quite struck when he said that. There are generational forces at work here that I'll be very curious to see how they affect the response to this revival.
Well, that's the question. Is it a period piece? You know, is it so anchored in a reality that does, or in a fantastical sort of version of reality that is sort of passé? I wonder about that. You know, there are aspects of this play that, as you say, really go to a much more urgent, potentially, you know, a death-threatening time in the history of gay life in this country, or it was just sort of at the receding edge of that, I guess. But I wonder if that's going to have that kind of urgent quality for a younger gay audience today.
I don't think it will, but I don't think it matters, because if I'm right that Angels is a history play, or that it's going to be received as a history play, then people will find their own meaning in it. They'll find that its own their own relevance.
Yeah, I agree, because I think to me the word relevance is a very tricky one. I mean, we saw with the public's Julius Caesar that craven quest for relevance was terrible. I think you have to trust the audience to kind of fill in the blank. And you could argue, this is a devil's advocate thing, you could say, okay, look at AIDS in the play as the idea of, you know, this apocalypse coming, which I think is very much part of the play.
True.
And I don't know how you could not feel that dread now.
Right.
I also, at the same time, I don't want to take away from the specificity of, I don't want to de-gay the play by saying that. It's very much part of what it is. But I think the sense of dread in the play is very, very much present now in our consciousness. Consciousness. Oh, whoa. I don't know what that was. Just made up a word, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, I actually think Marianne Elliott is a great choice. I did not see that in London. I didn't see any of the broadcasts. But
right.
She's a great storyteller. The problem with the Michael Griff production at Signature of Broadway, which is the last revival that was in New York, I think, and there was also a touring production of the Ivo Van Hove production that played Bam. But the one at Signature, and probably that had to do with the small theater, it felt very small. Like when the angel comes, you have to just, it is apocalyptic, and you cannot play this small. It's not a catch play.
No,
that's not been my experience. I've seen Angels done regionally in small houses, and it's really just a question of design, of the imagination, of the design concept. You can make something big happen in a small house if you know how to do it. But we were talking about the historicity of the play, and of course we've forgotten that it has another historical figure in it, Ethel Rosenberg.
Right.
Yes.
And I wonder very much how the presentation of her in this play is going to land, first of all, with a generation that doesn't know who she was, and also in light of the fact that you now have a considerable amount of historical evidence suggesting that at the very least, Tony Kushner's interpretation of her guilt or innocence mm-hmm. is a little bit problematic. That was tricky the last time I saw Angels, which was in Chicago.
Well, the other interesting thing is this recurring theme of Russia and our relationship with that country. You know, again, it sort of flips it again. You know, they're, the red diaper baby generation, or the people who remember that time when socialism was actually, the play deals with McCarthyism among many other things. But these things all, sort of mutate over time. They evolve in the way we perceive them. And I don't know if will she be perceived as the sympathetic figure that in that glorious scene when she's sort of, at his deathbed, which is, kind of marvelous, how that will come across to this generation, to a new generation.
It's really tricky. The phrase period piece, people usually, I think, mean it as a pejorative.
Yes.
And I don't always use it that way. Mm. For me, ultimately, every work of art becomes a period piece if it partakes of its moment. But sometimes that's when it gets really interesting, because it breaks free of the moment and starts to achieve a wider range of implication. And I'm thinking that may be what happens to Angels when we see it now.
One thing I'm worried about, I think of Marianne Elliott, the director, as a visualist. The pieces that she's put on the stage I've seen have worked really well with puppets and flashing lights, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime and Warhouse we've discussed. I think of Angels, and I think this is not emphasized perhaps enough, Angels is a great piece for actors. I mean, those roles are magnificent, and the characters have so much time on stage to sort of develop and breathe. I want to see that happen with this production. And yes, of course, Nathan Lane is trying to redirect us, make us think of him as a serious actor as opposed to a comic actor.
Well, I think he's been doing that for a while now. It's not new.
True. No, and I'm really interested to see what he does. But to me, that's the other facet of Angels that I think, really has to hit you really strongly.
Well, I'd like to just put something out there too, is what is the legacy of Angels on American playwrights? Mm. It was in 1993. Can you think of any playwrights who were influenced by it? Is there, and also in terms of Kushner's career, it is such, actually, Caroline or Change, I would say, it's one of my favorite musicals.
It's a lovely piece.
In terms of plays, it's been very hard for him, and he's done great, actually, work on screenplays. But in terms of plays, it hasn't been, and it's a burden. It's a burden, I think, for a playwright. But what about other? Do you think it's a complete, it's a UFO? It's just a...
Well, it may be, but let me speak to your first question, because the new book speaks very directly to that, because the two guys who compiled it asked a whole group of playwrights, younger than Kushner, to talk about what effect the play had on them, gay and straight alike, and it was tremendous. And to a person, they, as if my memory serves correctly, they talked about how it inflamed the sense of ambition, the desire to try things that were not easy, to compact into a small house, into a small cast, to really cast the net widely. And entirely aside from the question of Angel's intrinsic merit, which is something that has to work itself out, it's already left a mark I dare say now, by now, on two generations of American playwrights in terms of giving them a sense of what is possible on the stage. And that's going to be a very big part of the show's
Yeah, I think also the freeing of imagination in that play, you can see it in the work of people like Sarah Ruhl. I do think that there are playwrights who were deeply affected, and I think there are that next generation of writers who saw the possibilities for taking hard subjects and in directions that are completely fantastical is attributable to what Tony did with this piece.
Right, but that's a big question that you asked Elizabeth a moment ago, which is, has Tony Kushner written one play that stops him dead as an artist?
Mm.
And again, the answer to that only comes at the end of his creative life when we look back on it and see what effect it had. It is possible that he said what he had to say in Angels. Sometimes novelists in particular have one thing to say, and they say it in a large-scale work that makes a colossal impression, and they spend the rest of their life repeating.
But how do you drop two bombs like, bombs in the best sense, explosions culture, and hope to ever replicate that? It's almost, an impossible task.
Well, look at Ralph Ellison. I mean, when the first thing you write coming out of the gate is Invisible Man, that's not just a tough act to follow. For him, it was an impossible mm-hmm. act to follow. And I esteem Kushner for clearly having said, I'm not going to stop there. I'm going to write The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide. I'm going to work in film. I haven't said my piece yet. So maybe he has, but he's not acting as though he has. And good for him.
He's still saying it, just in different mediums and in different ways. And I think it's hard for some people to accept that someone will try something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think we all do have that in the back. I've talked to him over the years, and there are plays that never happened even that he had huge ambitions for. So I don't know if it was just distraction by these other opportunities. But he's probably got another 20 years of writing life left. So, let's see what happens.
Yes, indeed.
Well, anyway, we're all going to be seeing Angel shortly or lengthily. So maybe our specific responses to it are for another episode. In the meantime, let's shift gears now and welcome our guest, Chris Jones, for some picking of his expert brain. Specifically, we're going to switch to the question of how the biggest national hit in many years, Hamilton, is faring in his backyard. And what that experience there says about the potential any show has for creating a national theatrical conversation.
Chris, to start us off, you recently pointed out in a remark online that Hamilton has been running in its own sit-down production in Chicago for 18 months or so, and that tickets are pretty readily available on many nights. Now, this development seems contrary to the widely held assumption that the public embrace and visibility of Hamilton goes much deeper than that. So can you give us a sense of how Hamilton is faring in America's second theater city? Are there any indications that there's some variability in the show's popularity as it makes its way throughout the country?
Well, Hamilton has been a very big hit in Chicago. There's no question about that. And over the Christmas, New Year period, I think it beat any gross of any other show, and it's $3 million or some ridiculous thing like that. So that's absolutely the case. But when you've got a show that's been running 18 months, 20 months, you end up in the cold, shivering January in Chicago on a Tuesday night, I tend to prowl the Ticketmaster site because I get so many questions from readers about it.
I love
and
that.
So I prowl it frequently, and I began seeing popping up, orchestra on the side, $80, $85. And when I heard the news from Washington that people, as Peter reported, that I think, some massive percentage of the entire population of the District of Columbia was in line virtually for the show, I was like, it would make more sense to hop a $200 plane ticket to Chicago, probably see a better production because they've gelled for a long time, than it would to, cough up that money in Washington. And you can have a good steak and, mashed potatoes when you arrive.
A good Chicago steak. Yeah, I do think that there's an interesting, you know, notion here, which is that there is a finite audience for Hamilton, yeah. which I think we've all led to believe, and maybe our own writing has, you know, given an opposite impression. But that maybe there is a limit in a great theater town like Chicago that's to the ongoing rejuvenation of an audience for the show.
Well, you know, I think, as I said, I think winter's difficult, and I think we get in the spring break period that those prices that I was seeing will probably disappear as the tourists come back and things heat up again. So I do think that's the case. But, you know, the other game that gets played on the road a lot is, you know, what they call clearance, which is the idea of how far, you know, how near is the other Hamilton production, right? Which is, of course, I think partly why they didn't rush into Washington, because it's a little close. You know, Chicago is further away from New York.
Right.
So they were protecting the market around New York. And we've got a situation now in 2019 when the national tour rolls out, where, for example, where I live in Chicago, you're going to be able to see Hamilton in Milwaukee, which is 90 miles up the road. You'll be able to see it in Madison. You'll be able to see it, I think,
like Six Flags. There's always exactly. one near you.
So the moment you have a lot of, you know, then at that point, so now what's happening is if you're in Milwaukee, whereas you would have driven down to Chicago to see it for the last year and a half, now you're saying, well, we'll just wait till it comes to Milwaukee. So that's a sort of an issue. And I think there's a strategy shift, although they deny this at Hamilton, but it seems to me that they decided that, you know, they're going to push it out to the smaller markets. In a way, say that Wicked didn't. So Wicked was in Chicago for 3 years, for a long time.
Part of what makes this interesting is we're seeing a real historical change. The reference show that people frequently mention in connection with Hamilton is My Fair Lady, which was for years and years the show that you couldn't get tickets to see in New York for a period of several years. But back then, there was no regional theater. The whole situation was different. And it makes me wonder, you ask about finite audiences for Hamilton. I assume that there is a finite national audience for Hamilton, that eventually you reach the point where everybody who wants to see it has seen it. And if you're running it in several cities and then you roll out a tour, you're going to reach that point sooner. It's just an inevitability.
Do you think also, it's still doing very well in New York. Do you think it's because now it's become part of what you do? If you come visit New York, you go yes. see Hamilton. But do you think this is going to, the fact that more people outside of New York will have seen it on the road, will they say, oh, I'm going to New York on vacation, I don't need to see Hamilton, I saw it in Milwaukee or Chicago?
You know, I think,
Especially if they can't get into it. That's really the key.
Right.
Sooner or later, you reach a point where you're beating your head against the wall and you realize, no, I can't get into Hamilton, so I'll see something else.
I think, you know, the show in New York is less hot than it was. That's a fact. I mean, it's still a hot ticket, but it's not quite on the boil that it was a year ago. I think people in the theater forget the barrier of price for people. Like, I think people think of Hamilton as a very expensive ticket. If you went to an average, you know, average Joe or Jane on the streets of Chicago, said, you want to see Hamilton? They'd go, yeah, but, you know, that's like $500 a ticket.
Wow.
And so that, you know, there's a finite audience, Peter, I think, at the prices they've been charging. You know, if they can find a way to reduce price, and maybe the market will do that.
It was weird. I was in London last week and I was staying in a hotel and these two women from New York were talking in the lobby, and I heard them mentioning a show and they were saying it was about history. And I said, did you just see Hamilton? They said, yes. How did you know? I said, you're from New York and you're first seeing Hamilton. You say, yeah, we just sort of, we got tickets. It was part of our tour. You know, there still is this, there are these layers though of penetrability of the marketplace. And I do think it's interesting that, you know, we do assume that that it's better to, you know, to charge these reams of dollars, I guess, because later on you can always discount.
That's right.
But I wonder also, Chris, does Hamilton have the sort of impact on a theater town like Chicago that it had in New York? Do you feel that kind of revolutionary quality, or do people take it more as a with a larger grain of salt? It, you know, there is this kind of captivating notion in New York of Hamilton is this kind of, as Elizabeth said, this must, you have to go see it if you have a certain amount of money.
Well, Yeah, before Chris answers, it was the kind of show that you felt you had to see whether you went to shows or mm-hmm. not. And we haven't had many of those in recent years in New York, something that really reached beyond the normal theater audience. Did it do that in Chicago?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got to remember this has been playing now for a long time. And, obviously one of the central ideas of Hamilton, I think, is that New York is the center of the political discourse, not Washington. I mean, that's one of the central
themes. That's interesting.
One of the central themes that it makes. That show is a play for New York over Washington. You know, Washington, marginal, just a random choice, not that significant. Everything that really happened was in the greatest city in the world.
I'm sorry, Peter Marks. I'm the backwater post.
So, no, my wheels are turning. I think I'm thinking guest idea. Column by Chris Jones in the Washington Post.
Sounds good to me.
And then Chris will be paraded down Pennsylvania Avenue for people to throw rocks at him. But that's a really interesting
idea.
I think
that is true. So, yes, you do it in Chicago. Does it have the same link to place? No. But, it was a big hit. Everybody went to see it. It's just, it's a lot of very expensive tickets. That's my theory on it. And I do think in my town we have more price resistance.
Well, one of the things that prompted this discussion actually was the Kennedy Center ticket sale.
Yeah.
What were the ticket prices there? Because there was like some kind of scene with crazy lines.
Well, this was one of those situations where you had to subscribe to their entire season.
Right.
To get first in line to buy tickets, and then there was a second wave. Because members of the Kennedy Center, who also have like subscriptions to the opera or to the symphony, were the next in line. So a lot of people bought memberships at the Kennedy Center to get that second tier access, and as it turned out, there were only a limited number of seats available to the members before it went on sale to the general public, and those people felt rooked. They had paid $60 for the right to buy tickets for $400 or whatever it was. Not only that, but the service charge, it was a percentage of the overall price of the tickets, and people were paying service charges in the hundreds of dollars. What? I mean, it's out of control.
Right.
So I think this backfired. I think it added to people's sense that theater is a Byzantine process and it's a club for people with a certain amount of access and money and that everyone else can get screwed. I mean, there is that kind of feeling. So I think it
also – I'm sorry. Go
no. On. So I think that it – I don't think it helped, with the idea of the very notion that Hamilton is trying to foster, which is, open the theater to everybody. Everybody can be on stage. Everyone can tell this story.
And it really makes me wonder – how healthy has this concentration on Hamilton been? It doesn't look to me like we have a gateway drug here that is introducing people to theater. It looks like we have an extremely expensive and fashionable commodity that everybody feels that they must see. I mean, you can't even judge fairly what the long-term significance of the show will be. And I don't think we'll know that until people start doing their own productions of it. And we find out whether this play really is revivable.
I think once schools
versions
start
that have nothing to do
with
the original.
I don't know if they are already, but once schools start to do it, that'll be interesting.
Yes. No, but I don't know that any. I don't know that
in Chicago. Like,
it was interesting. I do not think it will run as long as.
Wow.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's partly to do. There's a number of reasons. I think one is the clearance issue. That's a huge issue because David Stone kept everybody out.
He's the producer of Wicked.
Yeah, and so that's part of it. I think it is harder now to run longer. I mean, I just think that's generally the case in the city because there's just so much now compared to when Wicked was there. And I think Wicked is ultimately, Wicked is a family show that regenerates an audience all the time. I still think, the question though with Hamilton is this for me. Could Hamilton stay in Chicago for 10 years and be profitable? Yes. There's no question about that. But this is the question for me. If they go to other markets, they can make a lot more money. What they can't do in Chicago anymore is charge massive prices. They probably can in, say, Dallas or somewhere. So if you're smart and you're in the commercial business, you're going to take that production and go there. That feels to me a likely eventuality. But, you know, I've asked Jeffrey Seller about this. He goes,
he's the producer of Hamilton.
Forget it. We're here forever. That's what he says. So we'll take him at his word.
Yeah.
We haven't even talked about this question. Presumably, somebody is going to want to film mm-hmm. Hamilton. But there's going to come a point where that no longer works. They can't wait 10 years to film it. They're going to have to do that sooner. And once they do, it is going to affect every other aspect of the box office all over the country.
Hmm. Well, if they want Lin-Manuel to be in it, they can't wait 10 years. But that's a fact. If they want, which presumably they do. So that's a good point.
Yeah.
You mean because he's
too old?
He's going to.
I actually don't share that there's an inevitability of filming Hamilton.
Really?
No, I don't think. Well, they could wait. Actually, I really do think they could wait. I think it's too dangerous for them. They're like, you know, at this point, we're talking about them like those pharmaceutical companies that are hiking drug prices by 700% because that's what they did. You know what? When you hike ticket prices to such an extent, I'm sorry, but there's a price to be paid by the customer. But also, I think in terms of the idea of accessibility and just this ruthless milking of just making a buck while you can, I find that completely disgusting.
You know, I remember...
And I understand it's capitalism, but, you know, that's another...
I remember tweeting at one point that I would never see it, probably never live to see another show in the Richard Rogers Theater, which is where Hamilton plays in New York. But yes. I maybe, you know, in the cold light of, you know, 3 years later, 2 years later, maybe I was wrong about that. Maybe it, you know, if Wicked's going to outrun Hamilton in Chicago, then I got to believe that it may not have the staying power elsewhere that show had.
I'll amend my pharmaceutical comparison by saying that nobody will die if they don't see Hamilton. So at least there's that.
Let me mention the obvious comparison to A Chorus Line, which opened in 1975. Was filmed 10 years later, and the film was not successful.
Or Phantom.
It did not make any real. It didn't make any real impression on the public, and I think that may be partly because of the intrinsic quality of the film, but also because they waited too long to film it.
Mm. I mean, Phantom is a typical example. They're waiting a long time, and nobody remembers the movie, and the show will be still there 30 years in.
Mm.
Oh.
Mm. Right.
Mm. Mm. Well,
all right. Well, I think. Sorry, I was pondering my Phantom experience. I love Phantom, so I'm going to put it.
I have never seen. I just tweeted this to everybody's amazement. I have never seen any version of Phantom on stage, on screen.
That is just
what? I've seen it 45,000
That's crazy.
Times.
Truly.
Okay, that is going to be a special podcast because the time when you finally see it. We're going to dedicate an entire podcast
wait.
You seeing Phantom.
What, you have never seen Phantom of the Opera?
No, I never have. And well, I came to Cats very late, too, and was absolutely horrified.
Okay, I wish you could see Peter's
face
right now.
That doesn't exactly increase...
The shock is...
It doesn't increase the likelihood that I want to see Phantom. But
oh, Terry, I'm taking you to Phantom, man. We're gonna watch that chandelier fall together.
I would love to go because I actually love Phantom, so...
Oh, good.
The best version was the 90-minute Vegas version. I saw that too. That was great.
And then
you didn't miss
the turbocharged
falling chandelier.
Right. Well, let's look. Okay, unfortunately, we have to move on.
All right.
We have to move on. Thanks, Chris, for dropping by.
Thank you.
We have another segment that we'd love to hear you. We usually talk about productions we've seen recently, and I was wondering if you could start us off and tell us about what you've seen recently in Chicago.
I've been very taken with a new play by a writer called Loy Webb called The Light. Is the name of it, and I believe this has not been announced, but what the heck, so let's break some news here. I believe it's going to MCC, and it's a play, it's a two-hander, African-American couple, and, you know, they're sort of loving couple, and he has tickets for her to a performance by a rapper that she likes, only this guy, this artist, this rapper has some some unsavory things have come out about this guy in his past. It's kind of a, it's a little bit of a riff on the Nate Parker situation, and then from there their relationship completely deteriorates. It's an 85 minute play. It's a little, it reminds me a little of Ayad Akhtar's Disgraced in the way it ramps up, and I think it's a great play. It's the best new play in Chicago this year, so I enjoyed that. I like the Chicago production of The Wolves, which has been seen in New York already, which I think play about
we had it in Washington too.
Plays. Excellent play. That's a really good time. So those are the two shows that I've enjoyed the most, and you know, the last few weeks anyway.
I think you said about The Light that it was a play about sexual violence roaring back into the present.
There you go.
Is there something Chicago drama about the play? Is there something particular, do you think, about a play like The Light that gets birthed in Chicago?
It's new work, and it's in a little studio, and you can't, that, you know, they, at one point it was a hotter ticket than Hamilton. It was harder to get, you know. It was more, it, of course, it was, you know, $30, but it was actually harder to get, and it was the most active audience I've seen in a long time. So people were sort of shouting at the play, people were crying. I actually saw a lot of people around me in tears at the end. It's a really good play. I mean, it's something. So, you know, now, of course, they can screw it up in New York, which they've done many times. So,
surely not.
Different cast, put a couple of stars in, completely ruin it.
So while we got you, Chris, give us a taste of what, is there something in the spring that you're particularly keying on in Chicago?
Well, we've got a new production of An Enemy of the People, directed by Robert Falls, at the Goodman Theater, which actually opens this week, which I'm intrigued to see that. You know, we've had a kind of Ibsen moment. We just had Michael Shannon directed a new play that was actually an adaptation of the very same Enemy of the People.
Wow.
So we're having an Enemy of the People moment.
An Ibsen moment.
Which I don't, you know, there you go. Rainn Wilson from The Office is going to star in The Doppelganger at Steppenwolf, which I think everybody's pretty into. So there's cool. a couple of good things coming up.
Oh, very cool. Terry, what production you've seen lately do you want to talk about?
Well, I'd like to say a few words about David Rabe's new play, Good for Otto.
Oh, I've seen that too. Yeah.
Which originated in Chicago, I believe.
Right, oh, in which the new group is now performing off-Broadway at Signature Theater.
It's
uncharacteristic of the present theatrical moment in a lot of different ways. It's a very earnest play about a community mental health center that has a cast of 14 and plays for 2.5 hours.
It's to three.
Yeah,
to be perfectly honest, I expected it to be a bit of a snooze fest, but it's not. It is a very strong show, honest, funny, moving, and it has a really extraordinary cast led by Ed Harris and Amy Madigan, and featuring all sorts of familiar faces, prominent among them F. Murray Abraham and Mark Lynn Baker, who have been welded by the director into a true ensemble cast. It just goes to show you that a critic's first and most important job is to be present, to see the show on the stage instead of the one in his head. I expected to hate Good for Otto, and instead I loved it. In fact, it made me cry, which is no small thing for a hard-boiled New York drama critic to say.
Well, I think you'll
hard-boiled.
I think you'll cry. Yeah, hard-boiled. I think you'll cry at Phantom too, Terry. I do. But anyway, that's great. Elizabeth, what's floated your boat?
Well, actually, Good for Otto is a new group production, and my choice is also a new group production. They're having two at the same time, mm-hmm. and it's Jerry Springer, the opera, which is by Richard Thomas. Was done in New York about maybe 10 years ago, mm-hmm. I want to say, in a concert version at Carnegie Hall with Harvey Keitel, and it was awful. Because Harvey Keitel could not act on stage. It was just really boring. But this production is directed by John Rando, and I absolutely loved it. It's really, really, it's very funny, first of all. But there's some kind of weird little heart beating in there under the darkness. And it's brutal and just incredibly entertaining. And Richard Thomas, I think, has written, for me, one of the best musicals of the last 20 years. And maybe it took a British guy to do that about this little slice of tawdry American, the tawdriness of American psyche. And I'm going to actually talk briefly about a show that I did not like that got a lot of praise, and it's Hangman by Martin McDonagh, which is clever but not smart. And really, as talking about little beating heart, it has none, which is a problem I usually have with Martin McDonagh. And is that how it's pronounced? I don't even know.
You did it well.
That's right.
For once.
Brava.
I was not impressed. I mean, it's just very well done and incredibly well acted, but for what? Like, the stakes feel so low.
Oh,
there's
come
just
on.
Nothing going. Oh, please do.
I'm a McDonough fan, and I'm a little slavishly devoted to him. But I had just seen, I had seen it on NT Live, the British production. I don't know. I didn't see the Atlantic production, but I was really taken with the with him, as I always am, with the language, with the world he creates. Very much like Three Billboards for me.
You know, but I understand. Yeah. I have a feeling that he is going to be, for this generation, the mammoth, the guy who divides people right down the center. You either like him or you don't, and it says as much or more about you as it does about
him. Actually, I agree with that mammoth comparison. They're two men with incredible facility with language. It's incredibly well written, and for what? I'm completely not interested in any of it.
Well, I'm going to take us all to London for a moment for the show I'm going to talk about, which captivated me. And it was The Girl from the North Country, which has gotten very good reviews in London, but I don't know that it's gotten universal acclaim from people I know who've seen it. I loved it. It's Dylan Song's set to a story set not in the North Country of England, but in Minnesota. And
oh, God.
Sorry.
I wasn't warned there would be accents.
Yeah. I
it's
wasn't warned either.
Today.
He did the police in different accents.
Yeah. But anyway, I heard you speaking in the north of England where you're from. So I tried a little bit of a homage. But anyway, it's exquisite, and the songs don't sound anything like Dylan, whose voice I've never, if I have to admit, loved. But these songs are massively entertaining, and the setting is gorgeous, and the acting is superb. If it doesn't come over here with the cast that it has, I'll be very upset. But we'll have to see.
It's got to be better than that Twyla Tharp show was.
Oh, yeah. No. It erases the memory of Twyla Tharp.
Which I
kind of
liked.
Oh, dear.
Naturally. Of course. Of
course. We'll deal with Elizabeth. You later.
Of course. That goes without saying.
I enjoyed it because I'm completely not invested in Dylan in any way, shape, or form. So I came at it with a pure, open heart.
Well, Peter, we'll be looking to see if the production of The Girl from the North Country makes it to our shores. And that's going to do it for today. Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, a lot of fun.
Well, you could come anytime.
All right. Absolutely.
All right.
We'll be back with another episode soon. I'm Peter Marks.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Terry Teachout, and you've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle, and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com, and both of them are spelled out.
Yes. Let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear on future podcasts.
Thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Isle.